This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking.
It's Thursday, the 24th of April. This is your BizNews briefing. I'm Bronwyn Nielsen. After steadfast opposition by the Democratic Alliance, lawyers acting on behalf of the Minister of Finance have approached the DA's legal representatives with a proposal for an out-of-court settlement. This follows the DA's application to interdict the VAT increase, which the party has opposed from the outset on the grounds of its impact on already struggling South African households. This development marks a major victory for the DA and a turning point in the fight to protect South Africans from what they say is unjustified financial burdens. Let's dip into the DA press briefing.
It came as a surprise to me when very late last night, I was called by our lawyers to say, we have been approached with a settlement offer by the lawyers for the Minister of Finance. Why did that take me by surprise? Because less than 1 week before that, in his answering affidavit in our court case, the Minister of Finance made it absolutely clear that the VAT increase of 0.5% would go ahead on the 1st of May. And that was merely a week ago today. And in that replying affidavit, it's a thick wad of paper which is over here, the minister says the VAT rate is therefore set to increase to 15.5% on the 1st of May. That was the culmination of a long argument as to why it was necessary and why it was unavoidable. Now, what happened between last Thursday and yesterday, which was Wednesday? What happened was the DA's challenge, which was heard in court on Tuesday. And that day was absolutely pivotal because our excellent legal team made the case as to why the VAT increase should be interdicted and why the minister had made the announcement in terms of an unconstitutional power allocated to him under the VAT Act. And secondly, why the process by which the Finance Portfolio Committee had supposedly adopted the fiscal framework when that proposal was actually never before the committee, and why an unlawful outcome and irrational outcome of the Finance Portfolio Committee had landed before Parliament as a whole, which adopted a fiscal framework that had unprocedurally and unlawfully and irrationally emerged out of the Portfolio Committee and the Standing Committee and the NCOP. The arguments were so clearly framed that I have no doubt that the minister's legal team went back to him on Wednesday morning, the day after our court case, and said it looks as if it is going to be inevitable that the 0.5% VAT increase that takes effect on the 1st of May could well be set aside by the court. And in that context, it seemed better for the minister to concede before he was perceived to have been forced to by the outcome of the DA's court challenge. And so the DA will now be pushing very hard for the necessary spending review. Long before this process began, we made proposals to the national government on how we could dramatically save money in the current budget to avert and prevent an increase in any form of taxation. The minister refused to listen to this. So we are now expecting from the minister's lawyers a settlement proposal, a formal settlement proposal. We will respond to that settlement proposal through our own lawyers. And if we can reach agreement, including on the issue of costs, we will seek to have that agreement made an order of court. There is a second crucial issue that comes into play here, and that is what Parliament will do around the Portfolio Committee's acceptance of the fiscal framework, or recorded acceptance of the fiscal framework, because indeed it was never put to the portfolio committee. And secondly, what we are going to do about Parliament's adoption of the fiscal framework that they assumed had come from the portfolio committee. Now, there's no precedent that we know of how that can be set aside. So it's important for us to say that while victory is a nose length away, we still have to cross the finishing line. And it ain't over till it's over. Then the question is, what next for the GNU? As people probably have noticed by now, we have a very strange coalition government. There's no precedent for what goes down in South Africa's coalition government anywhere in the world. No other coalition government in a country that has a proportional representation system would have survived what this coalition government so far has survived. In South Africa, we have to have thicker skins than normal. We have to expect the unexpected. We have to pave ways in contexts which don't even exist in other societies. So what the future is going to be for the GNU is something that I cannot categorically answer now. A lot will depend on what happens today.
Chief Economist at the Efficient Group, Davie Ruit, says the victory is significant, not from that perspective, but from a political perspective, and the fact that the GNU will last longer than he initially anticipated.
The decision by the Minister of Finance not to increase VAT, of course, is significant. The state will be losing or not collecting something like 75 billion rand over 3 years or so. But from a bigger picture point of view, it's really not that big amount of money. In fact, the overcollection of tax revenue in the previous financial year was roughly about 10 billion rand. And the increase in value added, or rather the increase in personal income tax, was in fact more than what that would have given. So the pressure really is on the Minister of Finance now to reduce state expenditure. And that's exactly where we need the pressure to be. The state is spending far too much money, and they need to cut back on state expenditure because the economy simply cannot afford this anymore. In fact, I believe that the decision by the International Monetary Fund to reduce their expectation in terms of economic growth for 2025 is much more significant than the decision by the Minister of Finance not to increase VAT anymore. But from a political point of view, this is really important. I think this will give a new leash of life to the Government of National Unity. It's probably going to survive a little bit longer now. That's firstly. And secondly, clearly, the ANC has got a lot of egg on its face here. And there's a good possibility that the Minister of Finance's head is going to roll. So this is much more important from a political point of view, really from a financial point of view.
ETM's George Glenos celebrates the news that we won't see a VAT increase, but he says we desperately need to see wasteful expenditure being cut from the budget.
It was a pleasant surprise to wake up this morning to the news that a VAT increase was no longer on the table. I think that some sense has prevailed. I never believed that it was the right approach to adopt. I think South Africa needs far more fundamental fiscal reforms to change the fiscal trajectory that the country is on and to stabilize debt. I think we need to look a lot deeper into fiscal expenditure, government expenditure, cutting back wasteful expenditure, reducing the size of government, finding ways to acknowledge the limited size of the tax base and to respect it a lot more than we are. All of that to say that we now need to think fundamentally differently about how we approach South Africa's fiscal position. I think we desperately need to relook at the size of the cabinet. We need to desperately look at the spending programs that we have and analyze whether or not the country is getting a bang for buck. I think we need to focus on efficiencies and drag many of these state institutions into the next century with focusing on IT and a lot of efficiencies that can be extracted out of that. There are many ways that a government can become a lot more efficient, and I think those need to be explored thoroughly. but defaulting to a VAT increase, in our opinion, was a lazy way of plugging a fiscal hole. This at least now forces the issue and hopefully opens up for discussions amongst the different political parties to find the best solution for the country. And ultimately, I'm hoping that it also forms a firmer foundation for the GNU, now that one of the most contentious issues that has threatened the GNU is out of the way. Perhaps the political parties can find ways of working more constructively together. So overall, I welcome the development, and I'm hoping for some more constructive developments in the future.
Colonel Chris Wyatt is well known to BizNews TV viewers. In a recent interview while in Cape Town, he took to the other side of the mic and interviewed Dr. Corne Mulder, leader of the Freedom Front Plus. Among other things, they discussed the ANC's declining voter support. Let's jump into that conversation.
I would say the ANC inherited the most modern, most strongest economy, strongest military power in Southern Hemisphere at the time. They inherited that on a silver plate. They succeeded in destroying it to a very large extent. There's nothing that the ANC did not touch that is not in trouble. Quite often, one of the most prolific things that we hear quite often is that we need a turnaround strategy. Everything needs to be turned around. Why? Because it was destroyed. Now, the reality is, after 30 years, we still need to deal with all the realities that's out there. People want to create a future. And suddenly, the magic of the ANC, and the ANC had a wonderful past. They had a free ride internationally. Everybody said, ANC, it's Mandela's party.
Everybody wants to be part of the rainbow experience.
Exactly. That has come and gone. And the reason for that is the ANC has gone out there and positioned themselves with all the rogues in the world, and they could not deliver internally. There's no reason why South Africa was not the powerhouse of Africa. We should be the locomotive that pulls the train of Africa. But they destroyed that. And suddenly, we are dealing with those realities. Ordinary people out there say, you did not bring a difference in my daily life, and we are looking for alternatives. And because of that, you see the ANC support is declining. The high point was in the second term of Mr. Mbeki, when the ANC had a two-thirds majority in terms of the elective result. Now they've gone below 50, they've gone below 40. They ended up in the last election 39. Opinion polls give them about 29, 30% now. So it's quite clear where we are going. They are on their way out. And that's just the reality. And people look with different eyes to the future and say, but there are alternatives and we can find a way to take South Africa forward. And we are part of that.
So there's a phrase that I used for a long time when explaining Zimbabwe. We're going back to the farm invasions before that. And I said that ZANU-PF got away many, many years with doing whatever they wanted with liberation credentials.
Yes.
They had liberation credentials. And I said there comes a time when liberation credentials don't matter anymore because
yes.
You have more people born after.
Exactly.
So that's the situation in South Africa. The majority of the population has been born since 1994, born free.
Yes.
So the only national governance they've ever known is the African National Congress. And with the exception of Western Cape, where we're sitting at, every other province has been governed, although I think maybe the IP briefly had the KZN, but
for a
short period of time. But other than that, it's been ANC at the provincial and the national level.
Yeah.
And they have worn out the liberation credentials, I would argue.
Yes, you can only go so far with trying to bring back the beautiful, glorious past from your perspective. But if you can't deliver, if you can't get the economy to grow, if you can't create jobs, if people see that they are getting poorer by the day, then people is not going to buy into that. And then obviously if you top that up with black economic empowerment, which is basically elite empowerment, you top that up with corruption.
Legal racism, actually.
Exactly. And you top that up with corruption, rampant corruption, crime, no service delivery that is quite effective. People say, no, enough. We can find a different future. We don't have to go that route. And that's why you see the absolute decline within the ANC. And then surely, but surely, the party is also breaking up into different
factions.
Aside, MK is a faction. The EFF is a faction. COPA is a faction. So it's breaking up.
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
In the world of business banking, the bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. out of the ordinary.
The IMF recently released the World Economic Outlook. The World Economic Outlook is a publication produced by the research department and published on a biannual basis, usually in April and in October. It provides a comprehensive analysis of the global economic situation, including economic growth, inflation, and other key macroeconomic indicators. A critical juncture amid policy shifts is the name of this release.
The landscape has changed since our last World Economic Outlook update in January. We're entering a new era as the global economic system that has operated for the last 80 years is being reset. Since late January, many tariff announcements have been made, culminating on April 2nd with near universal levies from the United States and counter responses from some trading partners. The U.S. effective tariff rate has surged past levels reached more than 100 years ago, while tariff rates on the U.S. have also increased. Beyond the abrupt increase in tariffs, the surge in policy uncertainty is a major driver of the economic outlook. If sustained, the increase in trade tensions and uncertainty will slow global growth significantly. Reflecting this complexity, our report presents a reference forecast which incorporates policy announcements up to April 4 by the U.S. and trading partners. Under this reference forecast, global growth will reach 2.8% this year and 3% next year, a cumulative downgrade of about 0.8 percentage point relative to our January 2025 WEO update. Our report also offers a range of forecasts under different policy assumptions. Under an alternative path that excludes the April tariff announcements, global growth would have seen only a modest downgrade to 3.2% this year. We also use a model-based forecast to incorporate the temporary suspension of most tariffs announced on April 9, together with the increase in bilateral tariffs between China and the U.S. to prohibitive levels. This pause, even if extended permanently, delivers a similar growth outlook as our reference forecast, 2.8%. Even if some highly tariffed countries could benefit. Now, while global growth remains well above recession levels, all regions are negatively impacted this year and next. And the global disinflation process continues, but at a slower pace, with inflation revised up by 0.1 percentage point in both years. These trade tensions will greatly impact global trade. We project that global trade growth will be more than cut in half from 3.8% last year to 1.7% this year. The tariffs will play out differently in different countries. For the United States, the tariffs represent a supply shock that reduces productivity and output permanently and increases price pressures temporarily. This adds to an already weakening outlook and leads us to revise growth down by 0.9 percentage point to 1.8% with a 0.4 percentage point downgrade from the tariffs only, while inflation is revised upwards. For trading partners, tariffs act mostly as a negative external demand shock, weakening activity and prices, even if some countries could benefit from trade diversion. This is why we have lowered our China growth forecast this year to 4%, while inflation is revised down by 0.8 percentage point, increasing deflationary pressures. All countries are negatively affected by the surge in trade policy uncertainty as businesses cut purchases and investment, while financial institutions reassess their borrowers' exposure. Uncertainty also increases because of the complex sectoral disruptions that tariffs could cause up and down supply chains, as we saw during the pandemic. The effect of these shocks on exchange rates is complex. The tariffs could appreciate the U.S. dollar, as in previous episodes. However, greater policy uncertainty, lower U.S. growth prospects, and an adjustment in the global demand for dollar assets are weighing down on the dollar.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has accused the IMF and the World Bank of mission creep, Besant calls for reform, but does stop short of pulling out of the global institutions.
Scott Besant had some choice words for the International Monetary Fund and World Bank yesterday.
The IMF and World Bank have enduring value, but mission creep has knocked these institutions off course. We must enact key reforms to ensure the Bretton Woods institutions are serving their stakeholders, not the other way around.
The U.S. Treasury Secretary said this during a speech at the Institute of International Finance yesterday. The IMF and World Bank spring meetings are taking place all this week. Here with me now to discuss this is the FT's U.S. economics editor, Claire Jones. Hey, Claire.
Hi there.
Good to have you back. So, Claire, when Besant said mission creep by the World Bank and the IMF, how would you characterize the tone of Besant's speech?
I think there was some quite big barbs there. I mean, he wanted to say, look, we're not going to do anything drastic. We're not going to pull out of the fund or the World Bank, but we're really not happy with the ways in which things have been heading. We want you to concentrate on the basics of the things you were set up for and move away from this broader and broader ambit of these things like climate, gender issues, social issues, and really get back to basics.
The basics being financial stability and global economic cooperation. Claire, what did the IMF and the World Bank say in response to this? Anything?
So we haven't had anything on the record from them yet. Later on today, we should hear from IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva and the World Bank as well. I think it hasn't said this officially, but I think the general mood is they feel as though the relationship between the administration is reasonably good and that they were already moving in the sort of direction in which Scott Besant discussed yesterday.
This speech comes in kind of a whirlwind of other economic and financial news. Besant indicated that the U.S. may actually ratchet down some of the trade tensions with China, that this tariff war may not be sustainable. Trump said on Tuesday that he has no intention of firing Federal Reserve Chair Jay Powell, even though prior to that, he indicated that he does have an intention to do so. How does Besant's speech fit into all of this?
I think the main concern has been for people gathering in DC this week for the IMF and World Bank spring meetings is that the US, which is the largest shareholder in the institutions, could pull out together. That was the idea in the conservative manifesto Project 2025, which some see as a playbook for what the Trump administration is doing. Now, Besant has made clear that the US doesn't intend to do that. I think that, along with the sense in which Trump has responded to markets' concerns over the Fed's independence and Besant playing down the likelihood of things getting worse between US and China on trade, gives the sense that even though things are pretty bad for the global economy and markets right now, they could be even worse.
Where does this leave the IMF and the World Bank as the meetings continue?
For the IMF, there is a sense in which the Treasury has taken aim at some of what have been some of the key policies of the IMF under Georgieva. You know, she's been keen to expand the mandate and talk about issues such as climate and social topics. It's clear that the US really, really doesn't want to do that. And it'll be very interesting to see later on today how the IMF managing director really responds to those criticism. I think the World Bank will feel that this almost gives it wind in its sails to carry on pursuing the agenda that it's put in place of, you know, shifting more to talking about things like jobs and away from things such as climate.
Claire Jones is the FT's US economics editor. Thanks, Claire.
Thanks a lot.
Tesla chief executive Elon Musk looks to right the electric car company by reducing his role in the Trump administration. Colleagues at the Financial Times have more on the story.
Tesla reported its lowest quarterly profits in years earlier this week. The results seemed grim enough to force CEO Elon Musk to reconsider how much time he's focusing on government. He said during Tuesday's earnings call, he'll be reducing his time in Washington and retaking the wheel at the electric car maker. Here to talk to me about the prospects for the company going forward is my colleague Stephen Morris in San Francisco. Hey, Stephen.
Hello.
So, Stephen, we talked about the top line numbers in yesterday's show. Tesla's reported net income dropped a staggering 71% in the first quarter. How much of that can we attribute to Musk's role with the Trump administration?
Well, even before Elon Musk became one of the most divisive U.S. political figures of modern times, Tesla was in kind of a tight spot. It faces increasing competition from increasingly sophisticated Chinese competitors, both in terms of the technology of the cars and also the batteries and range. And it has failed to develop and launch a new mass market model, excluding the Cybertruck, of course, which I don't think qualifies for that, for many years. And now on top of all of that, it's facing a consumer backlash in Europe and the U.S. from Musk's politics. And now it has to contend with tariffs and consumer nervousness as the U.S. economy may tip into recession.
What's Elon Musk saying about these concerns and criticisms? Does he have something up his sleeve to make investors feel better about the company?
Well, investors and analysts and online fans have been calling for him to spend much more time at the carmaker, considering the precipitous decline in shares and sales. And he finally caved to this pressure. In response, Tesla has said that it is going to continue with sort of a stripped-down Model Y, like the top-selling car in the world, and start putting that out to consumers later on this year, which could juice sales figures somewhat. But Musk's bet on Tesla is much bigger than just releasing new, cheaper cars. He's bet the entire company on AI and robotics. And there are certain people that believe he can pull that off, as he has many other improbable things in his career. And there are other people that think Tesla just needs to focus on doing what it actually was set up to do, which is make cars. And that's why we're seeing such divided opinions on the stock.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the stock price. It really shot up when Musk said he'll be taking a very stripped back role in government, but it's still down more than 30% this year. Do you think that this news is enough to change investor sentiment towards Tesla?
Tesla stock is going to continue going up and down, you know, with the vagaries of what Musk says and the performance of the sales. But remember, over the last 5 years, this is a stock that has increased 423%. And if we do start to see autonomous, driverless cyber cabs on the roads of Austin in Texas and potentially San Francisco, and we start seeing real world applications for these AI powered robots that can see and interact with their environments in real time, then there is a potential for huge upside. Now, of course, Musk is renowned for overpromising and underdelivering. So I think there's still a huge amount of uncertainty about not only the rest of this year, but the next 5 years of Tesla in general.
What are you looking at long term for Tesla?
Well, the biggest headwind at the moment is what happens through the rest of the Trump administration. When Musk was asked about Trump, tariffs, protectionism, supply chains, on Tuesday on the earnings call, he just let out a deep sigh and said that he was going to continue to advocate for free trade, globalization with the president, but he doesn't know whether he will listen. I do think this is going to be one of the major factors about whether Tesla is successful over the next few years, along with every other automaker in the world and probably every other company. Tesla builds more of its cars in the US than any other manufacturer, but it is impossible to disentangle its supply chains of rare minerals, various components from China and various other places. So the old adage in investing is never bet against Elon Musk. So I'm loath to say that this is a stock on the decline, but there is certainly more uncertainty about it than there has been in any of the previous 5 years.
That's the FT's Stephen Morris. Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you.
That brings us to the end of this BizNews briefing. We'll be back on Tuesday next week with more context, both global and local. Thanks as always for watching.
This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to private banking service now for your business.